This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. In part two of a special GLT series, we're looking for gaps in the Bloomington Normal Childcare Network.
Those families that can't get that supplement, it forces them to not be able to come to childcare.
April Steigerwald from Little Jules Learning Center and others on the front line say increasing state assistance for childcare is a good place to start. Plus, local schools measure the success of their new digital learning days, and a supporter of a higher minimum wage says the benefits outweigh the costs. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The patchwork of child care options in central Illinois has left many gaps that parents and guardians struggle to fill every day. In part two of GLT's series on child care issues, we look at the biggest gaps and learn about the organizations trying to help. Andy and Brianne Anderson pay $140 a week so their daughter, Brooklyn, can go to an in-home daycare in Bloomington while they work full-time. It's $560 a month, about $7,000 a year.
We're a middle-class family. We pretty much live paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, the cheaper you can get it, the better it is, but you also want the quality as well.
Andy is a plumber. Brianne is an administrator at a nonprofit. They live in Atlanta, just south of Bloomington. They don't get any help to pay for child care. Like many middle-income families, their household income is above the eligibility limit for the state's child care assistance program. So they're doing it on their own.
We just knew it was one of those things that we had to do. And so I think a lot of people can identify with that and the fact that when it's more of a need than a want, it gets priority.
Childcare's high cost and low level of government assistance are among many gaps in the Central Illinois childcare marketplace. These gaps may not always financially ruin families, but they make everyday life a challenge, as according to more than a dozen GLT interviews with parents, daycare providers, and childcare experts. Public K-12 education is financed almost entirely by the public sector through taxes and available to all children. Yet early childhood education involves substantial family payments. Many see room for improvement in the state's child care assistance program. To be eligible for partially subsidized child care in Illinois, Family of Four would have to make less than $46,000 a year. And even then, they'd be responsible for some sort of income-based copay. It could be as high as about $400 a month. Most pay between $100 and $200. The Illinois Department of Human Services says there are around 670 families in McLean County that get those subsidies, averaging about $650 per month per family. But that's often less than the full cost of care. It would cost Illinois parents who put a four-year-old and an infant in child care about $1,300 per month for an in-home option, or almost $2,000 for a full child care center. That's according to Child Care Aware of America's 2018 study. Dan Harris is executive director of the Illinois Network of Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies, or INCRA.
The state subsidy amounts, like in other words, what the state in effect pays a provider, is below the market average for much of the care, the majority of care provided throughout the state. And so that makes it difficult for parents.
Little Jules Learning Center's operations director, Mary Beth Lowry, says only around 15 or 20 of their 300 families are receiving state assistance.
It's hard to get for families to get that state assistance sometimes. They might make, quote unquote, too much for the state, but they're barely making ends meet. They're working, a part-time job, and they're in school, and they just need that extra help with their child care expense, too.
So how much would it cost to properly fund a new child care model in the U.S.? It would require about $48 billion in new public sector funding annually, according to a 2018 report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. It found a lack of harmonization among current financing mechanisms is leading to gaps in early childhood education. Their big overhaul would make it so families paid either no fee or an amount they could reasonably afford based on income. And it would pay early childhood education workers more. For Bloomington Normal parents who work full-time, there's another gap that needs to be filled literally every day, before and after school care. Locally, YWCA McLean County and Normal Parks and Recreation tag-team that need by offering low-cost before and after school care at several places around the community. Senior Director Melissa Breeden with the YWCA says they've got 350 kids who benefit from an after-school curriculum that includes mentorship and homework help.
It ties directly into our mission because we help to empower moms and dads to continue to work. We also work with foster families. We want to make sure that the children stay safe and that they're getting the best experience possible both before and after school.
With over 600 kids and 80 staff, Normal's before and after school programs are a bargain. After school care is currently just $21 a week per kid. Normal also offers scholarships for low-income families to cut the fees in half. But there are capacity issues. Marjane Gassemi of Normal told GLT she's tried repeatedly to get her two older kids into the after-school program at Grove Elementary, but she said she's failed repeatedly to win the lottery that determines who gets the 100 spots at Grove. Instead, Gassemi pays a college student $150 a week to watch her older kids after school.
Honestly, with the school program, I don't understand why there's a number limit.
Normal Parks and Rec Director Doug Damery says it's a facility issue. Normal's before and after school programs are hosted at 8 Unit 5 schools. And Damery says they don't have any more physical space to expand. 6 of the 8 sites are at capacity. And at Grove, where Gassemi's kids would go, there were 30 families on the wait list as school began last fall.
It's not so much a budget problem as much as a facilities problem. We use the school sites, and the school really is size of the school and the size of the rooms that we have access to kind of dictates how many kids we put in those schools.
Melissa Breeden says the YWCA programs generally don't have capacity issues, with one exception, infants. Many on the front lines of Bloomington Normal Child Care agree that infant care is a growing need.
We have one infant room, so that can be challenging filling that up. Once it's filled, it's filled. We can't move children up unless they're ready and they're at the appropriate age.
Katie Stell Martis owns Katie's Kids Learning Centers with 2 locations in Bloomington Normal. She says she sees a lot of preschools popping up, especially faith-based ones, leaving infants as a gap.
We've added an additional infant room to one of our locations and eliminated one of our preschool rooms because the need really was for quality infant care.
Infant care is among the most expensive for parents. In Illinois, it costs around $13,000 to place an infant in a child care center on average, according to the Child Care Aware 2018 study. That's the same amount as tuition and fees at a state university. Here's Dan Harris with that state child care referral group.
It's a problem if you're looking for infant care and to find a high-quality provider that meets sort of higher standards of care, or even just any provider that will care for your infant. There's waiting lists at most places, and it's a challenge for most parents to find a spot at any price.
Fixing child care is a monumental task, but we've done it before in bits and pieces. The Normal Parks and Rec and YWCA after-school programs are prime examples, and new solutions are emerging locally. After seeing a need for after-school programs for kids with special needs, YWCA and Unit 5 recently teamed up for a new after-school program at Colleen Hoos Elementary, a special needs hub for the district. Here's Melissa Breeden with the YWCA.
One thing about this community is it's saturated with child care programs, and I'd like to think ours is number one. However, there's so many different options that I think when you are a parent that has a child with special needs, it's easier for you to bounce from one to another instead of getting to the root of what the issue is and how to help that child.
Heartland Community College is attacking another unmet need. Evening care. Last month, Heartland launched a new evening care program for students with school-aged children. For $30 a week, Heartland students taking evening classes can drop off their kids between 5 and 9:30 p.m. They do their homework and other activities while mom and dad go to class. Director of Continuing Education Angie Coughlin says one story in particular demonstrates the need.
I met with a student a couple of years ago who was interested in our dental assistant program. And she was excited and really wanted to participate, but childcare was the barrier for her. And she had a 6-year-old. She couldn't leave in the evening and didn't have a place to take her. So she ended up not enrolling in the program, which was unfortunate. And there are other stories, many other stories like that. So we're hoping with this program that we can eliminate some of those barriers and provide necessary supports for our students.
That's Angie Coughlin, Director of Continuing Education at Heartland Community College, one of many places in town helping parents meet child care needs. GLT's series on child care continues tomorrow with what are the best big ideas to fix this broken child care system and how might that play out in Central Illinois. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Yesterday, you heard from the McLean County Chamber of Commerce and their leaders, who say a drastic minimum wage increase could harm some local employers. But Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker wants to see the wage at $15 an hour, and the Democrat-controlled General Assembly is set on making it happen in the coming months. Bloomington-based Illinois People's Action has spearheaded minimum wage increase campaigns over the last decade. Today, Executive Director Don Carlson speaks with GLT's Mary Cullen about why an increase is so imperative.
IPA has had a hand in Fight for 15 rallies across Central Illinois and even sponsored a Bloomington Living Wage campaign in 2008. It's safe to say you're in favor of a statewide minimum wage increase to $15. Legislators say $15 is fair. What do you think is fair?
Well, we think it's certainly better than the $8.25 that is the current minimum wage. And we do support the Fight for 15 and the $15 minimum wage. It would be nice if it happened quickly rather than being spread out for the next 3 years. It would be nice if the amount was greater. We've looked at the MIT Living Wage Calculator from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and they actually identify in McLean County for one person with one child, so mother and child, that wage should be $25 an hour. So $15 is better than $8. It's not as good as 25, but something as important as hourly wages, especially for low-wage, low-income earners, is really, really important.
Now, speaking with the legislature last week, the Illinois Retail Merchants Association say that they were hoping that Illinois would set up a tiered approach if they were going to increase the minimum wage. So that would mean minimum wage is based on a regional need. Like you just said, McLean County regional need might be $25. Is that a viable option, having a tiered approach? Why or why not?
Well, at what point did we decide as a society that even though you're doing the same work, given working at a big box store or a McDonald's or in the service industry of some kind, that you're going to get paid based on where you live? Especially considering you're doing the exact same work. It's a ridiculous attitude to take that for some reason that based on where you live, you should be paid less than some other worker doing the same job in some other part of the state. I believe right now we do have a two-tiered system of minimum wage where Chicago is greater than in Central Illinois. And, we're grateful for our friends, our workers in Chicago who are getting paid more money, but what worker in Central Illinois or downstate Illinois would think that they should be paid lesser amount for the same kind of work? If we're going to have a community that is statewide, where we really do try to build community, the last thing that you would want to do if you woke up in the morning is to say, well, some workers should be paid less and some workers should be paid more for the same amount, or in this specific case, for a minimum wage. Poverty is the same in McLean County for those who experience it as people who live in Chicago who experience poverty. So if we're going to address the issues of poverty and low-wage work, we should try to raise that tide for everyone.
Right now in Illinois, it's sounding like $15 is the golden ticket. It's not looking like it's going to be much more, but like you said, $15 is almost double of what we currently have of $8.25. So when speaking with the McLean County Chamber of Commerce, they say a direct jump to $15 could be detrimental to employers. Actually, they did a survey in McLean County, and 80% of employers who responded said that a $15 minimum wage increase would impact hours, employees hired, or lead to overall closure. With risks to businesses on the table, with the benefit of a living wage on the other end, what's the sweet spot in between?
Our approach is what's going to be best for the larger community and what's really going to help families. We're very pro-family. If mom and child are living in poverty in McLean County, the way they're going to come out of that is by a job that's going to allow them to do that. And that means an increase in pay.
Regardless, employers are saying if the minimum wage is increased abruptly or to a point that they won't be able to pay their employees, there are going to be impacts on the employee themselves. So how exactly are we going to walk the line of making sure that these employees are getting jobs, getting paid well, this $15, and making sure that those jobs are going to stay intact?
Yeah, I mean, to do public policy, you have one of two choices. You can either look at the reality of the situation, or you can talk about hypotheticals and Chicken Little kind of arguments. If we were going to make public policy based on what a small group of vested interest people who are individually wealthy themselves are going to choose, well, then we would have no minimum wage. That was the argument that FDR fought back in the 1930s. We've gone beyond that now. And we all know that poverty affects the state, it affects our community, it affects McLean County. And the way to get out of poverty is to pay workers more money. If we don't do that, then what we're going to do is increase in other kinds of governmental assistance. And a recent study that just came out in the context of this debate right now is that to increase the minimum wage in the state of Illinois would benefit 1.4 million workers in the state, which is about one-fourth of the workforce, would take 35,000 people off the poverty rolls, and would generate $19 billion in economic increase in the state. And that's because if you're paid a low wage, you're not investing that money in the stock market or in 401ks. You're doing things like you're paying rent, you're buying food, you might be lucky enough to be able to pay for childcare. That's all money that's reinvested back into the local community. So if the Chamber of Commerce wants to have government increase its subsidies, then that's their choice to do. That's just really a Chicken Little argument, and it doesn't make the policy discussion of how are we going to pay workers move ahead.
Whose survey was that again?
It was the Illinois Economic Policy Institute.
Okay, great. This is Mary Cullen. I'm speaking on Sound Ideas with Don Carlson, the Executive Director of Illinois People's Action. So there are only four states in the District of Columbia that have voted to increase minimum wage to $15. They're all at different stages in the process, with New Jersey passing the law this week to take effect later this year. So let's talk about overall benefits. We just got into some of them there. Obviously, higher mandated wages means more money, but let's get into more of the human benefits outside of strictly numbers. What are any obvious local impacts that are worth noting?
We just recently celebrated the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., and he had a quote that always struck me, which was, there's no such thing as menial work, it's just menial pay. And so if we thought more about the workers and more about how families are going to be able to survive in our community, then everybody would be on the same page of trying to figure out, well, what is the best minimum wage? What is the highest minimum wage that we can achieve? McLean County has a poverty problem, but the problem isn't so much in unemployment. The problem in McLean County is in underemployment. So people who still work, they work every day, but they don't make enough money in order to make ends meet. And so many underemployed workers will string together two or three part-time jobs together and will often work many more hours than a regular wage, a 40-hour-a-week worker will do, and then just start thinking about the effects of stringing together multiple wage jobs on the family. How are you going to see the kids when they come home from school? What are you going to do about the kids that don't go to school for daycare? Increased wages for workers is one of those magic bullets that solves so many other problems.
That was Illinois People's Action Executive Director Don Carlson, speaking with GLT's Mary Cullen about the impact of a statewide minimum wage increase. This is Sound Ideas. When is a school day really a school day? It's a question that's taken on new significance as Illinois districts take advantage of new flexibility in how state law defines a school day. Now a report on how local school districts are measuring the effectiveness of last week's first ever alternative learning days. The first thing that District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley wants you to know about alternative learning days?
We all recognize that it's certainly not as good as the kids being here in front of the teacher. So that, let's get that off the plate right away.
During last week's dangerously cold weather, District 87 canceled school for 2 days, but not really. They became alternative learning days, a first for the district. Students and teachers worked from home, checked in with each other, and District 87 got to count those as real school days, so they don't have to be tacked on to the end of the school calendar in May as so-called emergency days. But is that the same thing? Should kids learning at home count as kids learning at school? Riley says obviously everyone is best served when students are in school with teachers, but
short of that, doing meaningful learning activities now as opposed to having to come back in May at the end of the school year, we think can be more meaningful. Now, that's what we think, but we need to gather some information to help determine if what we think is reality.
That means surveys. District 87 is sending 10-question surveys to parents, teachers, and students about the pilot alternative learning days. One of the questions, should District 87 do it again?
And that will be a simple yes-no question, and that'll provide us with some good information.
This whole thing is only possible because of the new school funding formula that passed in 2017. For determining what counts as a school day, the law of the land in Illinois had been 5 clock hours of instructional time. But that provision disappeared when the new school funding formula took effect, leaving the minimum number of required instructional hours at 0. That created the legal flexibility for alternative learning days, a.k.a. digital learning days. Not every district did them. Unit 5, notably, did not. District 87's was a pilot. And about 1,000 students in the Hayworth School District did 3 digital learning days last month. Hayworth Superintendent Lisa Taylor says it evolved pretty quickly as teachers got the hang of it. Many gave their students a menu of options, at-home assignments like watching a video, having someone take a photo of you when reading a book, or doing a sculpture.
There's a lot of an elementary, you know, build a fort and then read a book in your fort. So I think it's just a variety of activities and then your traditional stuff, which would be logging into web-based learning that we already use and completing some of their activities in there.
Taylor says her district is already heavily reliant on technology, so it's not a huge adjustment. Most teachers use Google Classroom, and it's a one-to-one district where students get their own computer. But Taylor says they also plan for those without internet access on these days.
Students who didn't have access, maybe they were somewhere they didn't have access, so they don't have at home, they have an opportunity to make that up or corresponding assignments when they come back to school.
Back in Bloomington, it was a mixed bag for teachers. That's according to Joe Lewis, president of the District 87 Teachers Union, the BEA. He says junior high and high school teachers had a smoother experience because their students are already used to learning technology.
The elementary folks, they had a lot more concerns about how to get assignments to their students, and whether or not they could get feedback based on internet access, whether parents were home, for example.
Lewis says that with more planning time, teachers could make it an even better learning experience. And yes, of course, he says, it's better to have kids in school with their teachers. He sees this as a different kind of trade-off.
I see these as doing a cost-benefit analysis and determining whether, okay, a student has, we're going to have a snow day, we're going to have an emergency day. Is it better to have the student try to do something today than it would be, perhaps, to try to have the student do something on the last day of school, an emergency day that wasn't added on.
Kids love it, but winter weather school closures can be a real headache for parents who have to make alternate child care arrangements, sometimes in a hurry. Here's Barry Riley.
Generally, we had a positive response from parents, and although I would tell you that there were some who were disappointed in us doing that for a variety of reasons, some of which relate more to the logistics of trying to help their child. If, for example, if you've got a single parent who works or even both parents who work and have to provide daycare for their children, and they can't be there to supervise this, it made it difficult in some cases.
Lisa Taylor in Hayworth is also surveying her parents. So far, she says it's been overwhelmingly positive.
They have encouraged more. What we have said is teachers will check in at 9 and 2 via email because they're working in between. Some people are used to more immediate feedback and response to questions, so some more regular communication throughout the day. Some very good suggestions, some training for parents who maybe haven't used Google Doc or some of the platforms that their students are used to using.
But while school districts are trying to figure out if alternative or digital learning days happen again, a move is afoot to make sure they don't. Legislation is moving in Springfield that could add the five-hour requirement back in, meaning snow days might just be snow days once again. I'm Ryan Denham.
Today's morning routine was just like yesterday's. Same toothpaste, same breakfast. But what was happening in the world outside your door was anything but ordinary. Progress, unrest, lives changed forever. Every weekday starts out the same until you listen. Turn on Morning Edition and the world will open up before your ears in a way that opens your eyes. Start every day fully awake with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care in Normal, featuring short-term rehab, long-term care, and the Legacy Care Alzheimer's Unit. Legacy provides memory support for seniors and peace of mind for family members. Details at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. For decades, public health advocates have pushed for limits on smoking. They've included warning labels on products to limit on where someone can light up, all of which have helped bring down smoking rates. But in Illinois, a push to raise the smoking age has repeatedly failed to become law. For this week's Illinois Issues, IPR Sam Dunklaw takes a look at the chances it has this year.
Smoking and chewing tobacco used to be the norm. You might remember being asked a routine question at restaurants, smoking or non. But over time, health organizations, lawmakers, and even the military have been increasingly outspoken about the hazards of tobacco. Nowadays, anti-smoking commercials abound, like this one from the ad campaign The Real Cost.
Cigarettes are bullies. Don't let tobacco control you.
Illinois lawmakers put their collective foot down in 2007 when they passed a landmark ban on public smoking. It's been more than a decade since then, and public perception of smoking has gone from bad to worse, especially among young people. An average of 95% of high school-aged kids in Illinois say they've never touched cigarettes, according to the most recent Illinois Youth Survey. But while high schoolers are ashing traditional tobacco, e-cigarettes and vaping products are on the rise. That same youth survey says vaping rates in Illinois are up dramatically. You might not even realize that someone's vaping. One of the most popular products is Juul, spelled J-U-U-L. It can be easily concealed, since it's designed to look like a computer USB drive. Vaping involves nicotine derived from tobacco and can be highly addictive, like traditional cigarettes. All of this has led some state lawmakers and health lobbyists to double down.
We should do everything in our power to stop this devastating habit.
This is State Representative Camille Lilly, a Democrat from Chicago. She's one of the state house's leading anti-smoking voices. Last year, she was a sponsor of a plan supporters say would have taken tobacco, including vaping products, out of the hands of high schoolers once and for all, by raising the purchasing age to 21. She and others partnered with the American Lung Association to try to get it done. The association's Kathy Dre says supporters have tried to up the smoking age 4 years in a row, but that effort has been snuffed out every time.
We do set the precedents here in Illinois. It's very important for the Midwest, for Illinois, to pass these laws. And we're just not there yet.
That's because Tobacco 21 hasn't had enough votes to pass. Last year, the idea made it to the governor's desk. Here's former Governor Bruce Rauner, who spoke with reporters right after he'd vetoed the measure last November.
I don't think that's going to change smoking among young people, and it would heavily hurt the economy, and it would push more people who choose to smoke to our border states.
Supporters failed to get enough backing to override it, but that hasn't stopped health advocates like Illinois Public Health Association Director Tom Hughes from keeping a steady drumbeat against youth smoking.
The tobacco industry has recognized the age at which a person starts smoking as a key indicator to their own success.
The age restriction and the need for social distancing in order for them to never start smoking, that's part of the rationale for the bill.
On the other hand, tobacco businesses say it's not fair to restrict the freedoms and responsibilities an 18-year-old has. A common argument, if they're allowed to vote and serve in the military, why stop them from deciding whether to smoke or not? But some business owners, like Jason Smith of 618 Vape, agree with what Tobacco 21 is trying to do for kids. He's run vaping businesses in Carbondale and Anna for more than 5 years, and says he routinely turns teens away for trying to buy popular vape products for their underage friends.
My heart was to help people quit smoking, not sell to kids. It's wrong. I hate it. I wish it wouldn't happen that way. I didn't open my stores to do that.
Smith believes that raising the purchasing age alone won't do much of anything. He says more comprehensive ways of tackling the problem, like restricting where vape products can be sold, would be better still. Instead, he says shops like his are being scorned for being part of the problem when they could be part of the solution. Despite the objections, Tobacco 21 already has a lot of support. It has strong support among the majority Democratic Party, and some Republicans, like State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield, broke ranks to vote yes.
This is a vote that I'm making on my own personal beliefs. If we can take steps to make a healthier Illinois, I think we should do it.
The recent handoff of the governor's mansion to J.B. Pritzker could also give the measure the key support it's needed. So far, the new governor hasn't publicly signaled what side of Tobacco 21 he'd come down on. Meanwhile, more than 35 Illinois towns and counting have moved ahead on their own. They've bumped up the local smoking age to 21. Before the state of Illinois passed the indoor smoking ban more than a decade ago, towns were passing similar ordinances. When it comes to this year's Tobacco 21 proposal, supporters like Kathy Dre are more hopeful than ever.
There is still so much that we can do, and I hope that Tobacco 21 is our next tool in our toolbox.
I'm Sam Dunklaw.
You can read IPR's full report on raising the Illinois smoking age at WGLT.org. This winter has seen some huge temperature swings. There's even one today with a 40-degree drop to 6 degrees tonight. That means freezing and thawing. In this installment of the GLT Gardening Podcast Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells GLT's Mike McCurdy the freeze-thaw cycle can have a beneficial effect on the soil.
It only makes sense. The ground you walk on in the winter freezes, but different soils in different places freeze differently, and there are benefits to the freeze-thaw cycle. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Glad to be with you.
I have to say, I've given this topic practically zero thought prior to our preparation for this episode because I just don't garden or have much interaction with the soil in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ground freezing or is it the water content in the soil that's freezing?
I think that it's more accurate to say the water in the soil is freezing. And here in the Midwest, it's frozen for a moment and then it thaws out again. Right now, we're looking at some sunny weather with some high temps, which means the soil will loosen and then allow the water to penetrate further into the soil, as far further in depth and further in density, so more pores will be filled.
We're not really looking at layers here. The water is completely interspersed and mixed with the soil.
Yeah, and if you can, you know, if you kind of imagine, you know, a bunch of ping pong balls in a box and then all the space between the ping pong balls, that's where the water lies. And we know from Grow Corporate that all soils are a version of sand, silt, and clay. Wherever you live, those are the three basic components that make up soil.
So different types of soil freeze differently.
They do, Mike. And the light-colored sandy soils, they'll freeze more because they're lighter in color and they reflect heat, versus a dark-colored soil, which absorbs it.
So it's not really about the amount of water those types of soil can hold.
It's just one of the many nuances that affect the manner in which the ground freezes.
So is clay a light soil or a dark soil, and how does it hold water?
Well, clay horizons are usually down below the surface, so the clay can be light or dark color, and it doesn't have as much to do with it as it does when the surface color is light or dark. And the space in between the pores in clay is very, very small. So when it does get cold, a little bit of water that's in that few pores, it gets forced out as it starts to freeze.
Is this why we see frost or freeze heaves in the wintertime? I've actually planted mums in the fall, you know, and just plopped them in the ground. I'll walk back out there later, and that root ball is sort of halfway out.
Yeah, I can tell you, like, from in an urban area where the frost heaves and breaks the pavement, that always comes after there's been some substantial rainfall, or even, say, a water main broke and it saturated the soil underneath the street and the sidewalk, and then it gets really cold, and then that shows you how powerful the forces of freezing are.
And then poor ice, that's we're talking about clay. There's not as much in clay. What is poor ice?
Poor ice is the little bit of water that's in between all of the little particles of sand or clay or silt, whatever is down there. It also includes the early components for soil development, like dead bugs and frass, which is insect dung. All those things are down there. The difference is that the early pieces of soil building material, they're crushed when the ice develops.
Frass. I've learned something today.
Yes.
So it makes sense. I've not really thought about it much before, like I said, but it makes sense. There's a lot of frozen ground out there right now.
There is. Half of the Western Hemisphere is seasonally frozen, and a quarter of that area remains frozen permanently. You know, so you got your Klondike areas of Canada, other parts of Northern America, the high elevation areas, the Sierra Nevadas. All those areas have places where the ground just never thaws out. That's permafrost. Permafrost is also areas that may have not always been frozen, but have remained frozen for 2 years or more.
So do we know how climate change is affecting any of this, impacts on tundra, permafrost, agriculture?
The weather definitely has an impact in the manner in which soils freeze, how often, how deeply. And when water levels rise, that has a big impact on how water freezes at the edge where the water and soil meet.
So how does snow affect the soil? Good for it when it melts, of course.
Snow is a little different than rain. You know, it takes 10 inches or more of snow to equal 1 inch of rainfall. A thin covering of light snow on a sunny day can actually warm the soil beneath it, because the snow acts like a magnifier. And it's also why we can sometimes get early lawn diseases like fairy ring or snow mold. They come about because of this phenomenon. If it was bare soil, it's going to freeze more than the snow-covered soil would.
We talked about different types of soil. What about different locations?
Yeah, like the soil that's beneath a plant, particularly conifers. The branches as well as the needles, they shade the ground for more hours of the day. Sometimes the shade is dense enough that it never goes away. And those areas are going to freeze more deeply and sooner.
And besides soil underneath trees, what about the terrain, you know, on slopes, hills, that kind of thing?
Yeah, banks and slopes and hills, they have numerous factors that impact the exposure to sunlight, water moving on the surface or subsurface, and even how the air and the changing water levels play in there. So if the slope faces south or west, it's going to be warmed by the sun on clear, sunny days.
And you mentioned there's a benefit to all of this. Nature has adapted to take advantage of the freeze-thaw cycle.
That's the part that I find very interesting about this topic, is seed germinating is affected by freeze and thaw, because some of the seeds have to be broken free from some little case, and the freezing and thawing helps that. And then for a lot of the smaller seeds that we encounter in nature, they have a thick protective coating on them. The freezing and thawing of those small protective layers around the seeds is loosened by the freezing and thawing. It also helps damaged branches break free from the tree. It's always kind of a crescendo of events that brings the branch down to the ground. And we alluded to it earlier, when the soil freezes, it smashes stuff in there that's not already a permanent soil particle, and that adds organic matter to the soil.
So it continues to help it break down.
The cycle continues.
What about agriculture? Does it make soil prep easier, that freezing and thawing?
Yeah, it's there's a paradigm there, Mike, because sometimes when you look at a field that's been cultivated after harvest and you see the bare soil and the large clods, one would understandably be concerned about the soil erosion losses that come from rain and wind. But some of those forces actually go to work for the farmers and breaking those clods into smaller pieces as they freeze and thaw over the winter months, so that when the cultivator does go through there, there's less resistance.
So in my small garden plot, is bare soil the best, or should I think about a cover crop?
Well, for a small one, Mike, I think it's good to keep it covered because you could get every weed seed in town that blows in there eventually. Also, too, if you keep it covered, it's going to give you the opportunity to work on it at the earliest possible opportunity for the 2019 planting season. There are lots of garden blankets, if you will, that can be purchased that allow you to keep the ground from freezing entirely. And some of those, I think, were duplicitous to the concrete folks that tried to figure out a way to get concrete to dry during cold weather.
So not even a cover crop in my small plot. It's best just to maybe cover it, and that would keep the extra weeds from getting in there.
Yeah, and the cover crop's nice because you can turn it into the soil and you get this little boost of organic matter there. But an actual covering is good too because it does protect the ground from getting unwanted weed seeds and things deposited on top of the ground.
If you have any questions about freezing ground or soil or anything in nature and gardening, submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next time we'll talk about DIY chemicals for the garden. I assume some caution would be necessary.
Always with chemicals, Mike, that is for sure.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can find this podcast and all of GLT's podcasts at wglt.org. Matt Garrison says bandmates in Bloomington Normal cajoled him out of a 7-year music hiatus that began with the birth of his son 9 years ago. Garrison is a longtime English professor at John A. Logan Community College in Carterville. His return to music culminated with the 2018 debut album by a group he dubbed Matt Garrison and the Robber Barons. The punk-spirited Someone's Gotta Live in This Town is described by EMG Audio Labs producer Micah Hathaway as Van Morrison meets Johnny Cash. When Garrison returns to Night Shop in downtown Bloomington this Saturday night, it'll be the first public performance of the album with his full band. GLT's John Norton has more.
The 8-song country roots rock album is a testament to the disaffected, forgotten, and left behind. Matt Garrison chronicles workers chewed up and spit out during completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1860s.
And the Chinese and the high rush are fighting.
He finds the one-time wife of a rich man drunk in a ditch on the side of the road. A drifter on a raft floats down the Mississippi searching for a new life. They're common, everyday, mostly rural people you won't read about in history books.
As a lifelong member of rural communities, those are the stories that really appeal to me.
Matt Garrison grew up in Olney, a town of roughly 9,000 in southeastern Illinois. It's a place he characterized as a once very vibrant Midwestern small town with a farm family community structure. But he began to see his town decay even as a young man, despite the best efforts of those who lived in Olney.
At the same time, I became a construction guy for about a decade of my life between undergrad and grad school. And when I came back to grad school, I knew I wanted to teach at a community college just because I sort of felt like I had, you know, earned my working class bones, and those were my people, and those are the students and the population I really wanted to be close to. And so I guess those are also the stories I want to tell.
Well, I've been everywhere, but I'm back.
The album's title comes from a line in the song, I Belong Here.
Well, I'm gonna stick around, 'cause someone gotta live in this town.
It was written in 2002 after Garrison moved to Carbondale from Fort Collins, Colorado, a town he called a bright, shiny penny.
You know, Carbondale's sort of a tarnished penny. Don't get me wrong, Carbondale's got amazing soul, and I love it deeply. But when we first arrived here, you know, it just seemed like a kind of a slightly run down, more forgotten place than we had been living previously. You know, that's kind of where that lyric came from. I don't mean for the lyric to be specific to Carbondale, Illinois. To me, it's just kind of something that I hope people feel about, you know, a lot of the small towns where they live.
And I belong here.
Though Someone's Gotta Live in This Town is his recording debut, Garrison has been playing music for nearly three decades. He first picked up a bass guitar at age 18 because he wanted to join friends already diving into the local music scene.
You know, I wanted to be part of the fun, and so we started punk bands in only Illinois in the mid to late 80s, when nobody had ever heard of such a thing around there. But we had a real thriving local scene in Olney through the early to mid 90s. It was really something to be a part of.
When you speak of me, speak easy.
And he stayed with music until the hiatus 9 years ago. From there, he said his guitar skills deteriorated to the point where he could play but one song on guitar.
That's how out of shape I was and out of touch I was with music.
It was 2 years ago. Friends now in the Robber Barons poked and prodded him back to his guitar. That this album even exists is a testament to the tenacity of those Bloomington Normal musicians he has worked with over the past few years. And you might know them. Drummer Rob Wills, bassist Andrew Moody, and lead guitarist Eric Fisher played together in Tim Callahan's retro garage band, New Kung Fu, which frequently gigged in the Twin Cities 6 to 8 years ago. Keyboard and accordion player Kevin Lowski played in the Irish band Bloomsday in the aughts. 2 years ago this month, Garrison finally had four or five songs he could play on guitar when those old friends gathered again.
And Moody, the bass player for the Robber Barons, said, let's do something with this. And it just kind of took off from there. And so I went from being kind of totally out of touch with music to having it kind of race back into my life and take, you know, kind of a center focus for me.
The song No Place to Hide from Matt Garrison and the Robber Barons' Someone's Gotta Live in This Town album continues his pragmatic look at small towns, this time from a younger perspective.
Won't you live there long enough, forget about being free. You know it only so well, like a map in a foggy dream. And they swear by the stepdaddy's graves how it has to be.
This is a harsh song. This implies that one of those small towns you're writing about is, for a lot of people, a prison.
Well, at times for me, as a young person, my own small town became a prison. And I desperately wanted out. And I did get out. And in my 20s, when I was working construction, I moved all around the country. I lived in North Carolina, Wyoming, Oregon, Colorado, before eventually kind of being, you know, drawn back into the Midwest, just because it was where my sense of home is. So I don't mean it in any way as a criticism of how people live in small towns. I think instead maybe it's more of a reflection of the way,
sure,
kind of conflict I felt about it at times.
No place to hide.
Surprise, both musically and lyrically, is just one of the delightful aspects of this impressive debut from the 46-year-old Garrison. Just when you think you have a song figured out, a different instrument, chord change, or even vocal cadence emerges. The English professor says those flourishes were unconscious.
Except that as a writer, or as a reader even, I really value surprise. When we're reading fiction, that is sort of the thing that really hooks us and sparks for us, is when a writer surprises us, whether that's with perspective on something or the way something is worded. As far as the music itself, you know, I think of a lot of that is just synergy. It's not just me. It's it's the robber barons and, you know, kind of the, some of the special moments that, that they brought to this recording.
On the song Not All There, Garrison breaks from observing others to reconstructing four flickers of childhood memories.
The first one, I remember a house.
I remember a house.
Built on stilts.
Built on stilts. Down by the river, there was a girl there. She had hair, color of a cotton mouth. Her eyes set so far apart. You couldn't be sure she wasn't looking away. And her eyes set so far apart. I almost gave my life away.
That whole thing was this memory I have of the first time as a kid that I ever set eyes on the Mississippi River. The next stanza, I remember three generations of women folk telling me, go out in the snow, stay away from the cove.
It
was a real story from when I was 5 years old, and when I walked out the front door of my grandparents' house, and they told me, don't go around the back of the house and go down by the pond, because that dock is real slick with ice, and you'll slip off the dock and fall through the ice. So I went out the front door and went around the back and went down to the dock and slipped off and fell through the ice.
And when I broke through the surface, I could not feel the cold. And when I broke through the surface, the fish moved away so damn slow.
I was rescued by my mom. She pulled me out by my hair, but nobody knows how long I was underwater.
Wow.
Every verse in that song is just random memory, but then the choruses are about how difficult it is as we get older to really be sure all of our memories are exactly what we think they are.
That's Carbondale's Matt Garrison speaking with GLT's John Norton. Garrison and his band, the Robber Barons, play songs from Someone's Gotta Live in This Town, Saturday night at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Mike McCurdy, and John Norton. I'm Ryan Denham. And this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's Public Media.